I mean, you send me some questions by tomorrow afternoon, then we will discuss them. I already got some questions from the first week, so we can also answer those ones. Okay. So yesterday we were looking at the IDS CFT recipe, and now we are going to look at models of extra dimensions and interpret them in terms of strongly coupled theories. So the first thing you need, the number one requirement for your model of electroweak symmetry breaking, is to produce electroweak symmetry breaking. At zero level, the electroweak symmetry breaking is, I have a gauge symmetry, electroweak gauge symmetry, and this is going to be broken down to E1 electromagnetism. At the level of, that's at the level of the gauge symmetry, at the level of the eigenstates, what you see is I have a photon, that's it, sorry, W123. I have the hypercharged gauge boson and the SU to left gauge bosons. And after electroweak symmetry breaking, the photon is going to stay massless. And that's why there is a conserved U1 electromagnetism, whereas the W's and Z's, which are a linear combination of the B's and the original W's, are going to be broken, are going to be massive. So we need massive W's and Z's. Okay, so what we learned yesterday is that if you look at the ADS picture, in ADS 5, you start with your space at Z equals 0 in the ultraviolet region, then you move forward, and if you don't add any infrared regulator, the theory is conformal and there are no masses, right? So the first thing we need to do is to add an infrared regulator, some infrared brain. But also, because the W's and Z's must become massive in the ADS picture, W's and Z's have to talk to the infrared brain. So we need the W's and Z's to be bulk fields. So the first requirement is we need the gauge bosons to be living on the bulk. Okay, so now we have a theory of gauge bosons in five dimensions. Plus, we have an infrared regulator. So we need to give some masses to some of these gauge bosons in a way that maintains the photon massless but gives masses to the rest of the guys. Questions? So what we saw yesterday, remember we were doing this scalar case? And we were looking at the two-point function that we generated. When this scalar was living in an ADS space with a little regulator here, or when we added the infrared regulator. So when we just add the UV brain and move it a little bit, we don't generate a Kaluza-Klein spectrum. We do, but this Kaluza-Klein spectrum is above M Planck, so we have no clue. So we really need to add a far away from the ultraviolet brain some kind of regulator, because this will induce new boundary conditions for my field that will induce this Kaluza-Klein description. So the presence of an infrared regulator is equal to conformal field theory breaking of conformal invariance. And the way we were discussing it yesterday is that by placing in a particular position in a space-time path a regulator, from the 5D point of view, it looks like you are adding an infrared cutoff. And the meaning is that I have a CFT, a conformal theory at high energies. It is conformal, but has some energy related to the position of this infrared cutoff, the conformal invariant breaks down. So that's the interpretation. Do we? That's the point. We want to be as general as possible. The only thing we know is that to break these symmetries, we have to start with massless gauge bosons and give masses to some of them. So for the moment, we don't think about the Higgs. We want to discover new ways of breaking electroweak symmetry.
But we're not interested in giving fermions masses yet.
Not yet, yes. We are like number one, the zero level question is, can we even get this? Okay. All right, so we have gauge bosons in the bulk of ADS or any star dimension. Can you think on a way of giving masses to these gauge bosons? that's always an option. No, that's completely right. So we could couple these guys to some combination of these guys to a scalar that gets a breadth. Yes, that will give masses. But there is even a simpler way of giving masses to fields in an extra dimension. So now I have a field that is living in five dimensions. I can play with boundary conditions. So you remember, if I have a plus plus boundary conditions, at the level of the zero mode, the lowest lying state is going to be massless. But as soon as I change any boundary conditions, I change this or this to minus, this low lying state is going to just be pushed all the way up, and I'm going to have no massless state. So one very simple way of breaking electroweak symmetry in the bulk is just by imposing a particular set of boundary conditions. So I can choose boundary conditions such that the W's and the Z's are massive. Yes?
How can we arbitrarily choose boundary conditions? Shouldn't they be dictated by something else?
What could that be? Be something else?
Arbitrary choice.
No, I agree. So you can. So at this level, it's just, yes, I can do that. I can just choose particular boundary conditions and lift some of the zero modes to infinity, whereas others don't get lifted. But now, so you're asking me, this is called an ultraviolet completion for this? So then you should come to think, what is leaving, changing from plus to minus boundary conditions? This means that instead of being the derivative of the field equals zero, is the field itself equals zero. So one way you can do that is by adding on one of the brains a localized kinetic term that is very, very strong. So a localized kinetic term will repel the field from approaching to this brain. So there are ways to do that. You can also think that this infrared regulator is just a gimmick. Actually, the infrared regulator will be some other effect from a string compactification or a black hole or something like this. And there you can also argue why some modes will get negative boundary conditions whereas others wouldn't. But that will be the model building part, even deeper modeling. But no, that's the kind of questions I want you to ask is, we choose these boundary conditions, we can do it. So, yes?
When you're doing this kind of thing, regardless of the boundary conditions, you always get like an infinite tower of masses, like those, like the only thing that decides is that if there is a zero mode or not.
Why do we focus on the zero mode? Is because this pattern of electroweak symmetry breaking is something we know at low energies. Whereas we don't know anything, we have very little data about things that are above the TeV scale. So we have to keep our mind open and think on all possibilities. So one possibility is that this theory is actually, instead of four-dimensional gauge theory, is a five-dimensional gauge theory.
Also, like expanding the Fourier series and only to keep the first
thing. Yes, exactly. So when you say my field in X and Z is a sum over Kaluza-Klein modes, what is nice about this decomposition is that, at least in a compact extra dimension, I know that Mn, the mass of this Kaluza-Klein mode, increases as the index. So I know that I will have heavier and heavier and heavier towers, but I will also be able to integrate out those heavy modes. So that at the end of the day, I can always truncate and say, okay, at low energies, I just care about the zero mode.
There is a constraint on the model that you don't want the KK modes to be too light. They do have to be above for TV scale.
So, yeah. So let's, what Callum is saying is true, so let's look at that. So let's say we choose these boundary conditions such that the mass of the Z is actually the first Kaluza-Klein mass. So I have now this theory where I have a zero mode, but I change from plus to minus boundary conditions, and this zero mode lifted. So now I don't have a zero mode, and my Z and my W is going to be the first Kaluza-Klein. But if the mass of the Z is the first Kaluza-Klein, it means that the mass of the Z prime, what you will call a Z prime, a guy that has the same quantum numbers as the Z, similar couplings, and is a little bit heavier. Well, so in any extra dimension, the mass of the Z prime is going to be of order twice the mass of the Z. In Randall-Sundrum in flat space, you look at the K tower, and if you look at the next line state, it's just order twice the mass of the lowest line state, no matter what you do. So we know that MZ is 90 GeV, and we know MZ prime should be of order 180 GeV, but we know that CAP bounds from LEP and then Tevatron, and recently even Vera from LHC, tells us that a Z prime similar to this guy with order one couplings is bounded to be M of Z prime bigger than order 2 TeV. So we need to break a little bit symmetry. We need to give masses to the Z, but just assigning to the Z as being the first Kaluza-Klein mode is not working. Why? Because the next line state should have been, we should have seen this guy already at LEP. So the simple idea of, choose boundary conditions and kill this and put everybody heavy is not working because of data. So that's good. We know already something. But there is a little trick you can play in ADS. So let's play this trick. This is a typical prediction from flat extra dimensions. And in most cases, in ADS, it's also a typical prediction. There is a little interesting phenomenon in ADS. And this phenomenon is called, in ADS, you can form what is called, or I call at least, ultralight modes. So let's see these ultralight modes. The bulk equations of motion for a spin one particle looked something like, well, we did it in the homework in the tutorial the other day. Right. So you solve this equation. This is, as usual, Fn is Z and some linear combination of J1 plus B Y1. Now let's see when we find zero modes, we know that there will be zero modes with plus plus boundary conditions. So if I set m 0 to 0, I'm looking for a zero mode, massless zero mode. Then a simple solution is that f is a constant. So I get f 0 is equal to c. And as we discussed some days ago, this wave function being a constant is only compatible with the plus-plus boundary conditions. So I remind you, plus-plus means the boundary condition in the UV and the IR, and plus means derivative of the field at the boundary equals zero. Why is this only compatible with plus-plus? Because if I assume there is minus-plus, plus-minus, or minus-minus, what I'm going to find is that C is equal to zero. Why? Because the wave function is completely flat in the extra dimension, and if I impose any minus boundary conditions, I'm saying that the wave function at some point in one of the boundaries is zero. But because it's a constant, the constant is zero. Okay. So the only way of obtaining zero modes in Randazundum is using plus-plus boundary conditions. But there is a cute fact. So, so let's look at the different possibilities. We have plus-plus. We have minus-plus. We have minus-minus. And plus-minus. What we are saying is that there is, if I call this zero mass, this is the mass. What I'm going to find is that here there is a massless state, whereas there is no massless state in any of the others. This massless state is a constant, okay? And then if I look at the Kaluza-Klein spectrum, you remember what is determining in the Kaluza-Klein spectrum is mostly the infinite boundary conditions. When it's plus, it's telling you that J0 of MNZ is equal to 0. So when you find the zeros of the Bessel function J0, you will find what are your Kaluza-Kleins. So what you're going to obtain is that the Kaluza-Klein spectrum for these two guys is similar, very, very similar. The UV boundary condition is not changing anything, because the way you end up finding these Kaluza-Klein modes is precisely by imposing something in the area. Okay, so what's going on in this other side? We know there are no zero modes. We know that they have different boundary conditions. So J1 of x is equal to 0. So you will find zeros of the Bessel function J1. And those are slightly, so you put this here, those are slightly heavier. So what you will see is that changing the infinite boundary conditions from plus to minus is just lifting the Kaluza-Klein spectrum a little bit. And this is a thing that is very interesting. And then if you just do this, you may miss. And it's that the fact that when you have a plus-minus boundary conditions, you are going to find an ultralight mode. So let's describe this ultralight mode. Why do we say that finding the Kaluza-Klein spectrum is finding these zeros or these zeros? Is because when we look at the conditions for the field and impose the boundary conditions, we were just approximating that the mass of the Kaluza-Klein guy times the ZIR was kind of order one. Whereas we were saying the mass of the Kaluza-Klein guy times the UV is very, very small. That's the way we obtain this approximation. And it works pretty well. But there is a caveat. It could be that this is actually very small, but there is one mode that happens to be much below the infrared cutoff. So how do we obtain that? Well, so let's now work in the assumption that this is very small, m of my ultralight, say AR, is also a very small number. So you look at the plus minus boundary conditions, the way you will obtain the spectrum is by saying, okay, so Fn is L A K1 plus B Y1. And plus minus means in the UV is a plus, meaning D Fn on the UV is zero. In the IR is a minus. Fn at the IR is zero. So let's apply these boundary conditions. Then we obtain something like J. If you apply these two conditions over this and obtain A and B, either A and B is zero, or there is a particular condition that must be satisfied, that is J1 F and then ZR Y0 of Mn. Let me call Mn ZIR U and Mn ZUV Epsilon, okay? That's because I hate having to write too much. Then the condition we need to satisfy is that J1 at U Y0 at Epsilon minus Y1 at U and J0 at Epsilon is 0. Okay. But now both U and Epsilon are very small. Epsilon is much smaller than U, but it's still. So we are going to expand this, assuming that U and Epsilon are much smaller than 1. So what you are going to obtain is, so you expand each of these guys for small arguments. It's very simple, and then you obtain something that looks like U over pi log of Epsilon over U equals minus 2 pi over U. Now, the only thing I've done is to take the first order in the expansion for these guys. So, for a plus minus guy, there seems to be a solution. So, for a plus minus guy, there is a solution of this equation, assuming that the eigenvalue is much smaller than the typical Kaluza-Klein scale. And this is going to be M of the ultralight. So remember, U is precisely my ultralight mass. And this is going to be 1 over ZIR squared, which is the typical Kaluza-Klein scale. But now there is a suppression. This suppression goes as the log of ZIR over Z UV. So for this particular set of boundary conditions, besides having the usual Kaluza-Klein tower that is of order 1 over ZIR, there is a mode that is below that and is separated by a large number. This is separated by the log of the infrared versus the ultraviolet scale. Okay, so we are there. In ADS, we are able to go from a situation where we have a zero mode to a situation where we give mass to the zero mode, and we still keep a big separation with the Kaluza-Klein tower. Remember, this is the guy we want to fit to be 90 GeV, whereas this is the guy we want to fit to be above the, or in the order of the TV scale. So an order of magnitude. So we need a log of order 10. Okay, so when we go from plus plus to change this boundary condition to plus minus, we change the whole Kaluza-Klein spectrum, but we also just lift the zero mode a little bit. So we now identify this ultra-light mode as the Z and the W, then we can do something based on extra dimensions. So that's the starting point for models of electroweak symmetry breaking in ABS. So, summarizing LEP and Tevatron, now especially LAC, impose a very, very strong bound of the mass of the Kaluza-Kleins. The second line versus the first line in Kaluza-Klein. So the only way to be okay with experiment is to create, you need to create a gap between the electroweak scale and the new physics scale. Yeah, sure, of course you need to create a gap. That's not big news for any of you. If you have new physics right at the electroweak scale, we would have seen it. So it must be, there must be some kind of gap between the two of them. And this gap is only possible in ABS or world, any type of world, extra dimensions. That's why there are no models, or no viable models of electroweak symmetry breaking in just flat space. Okay. So before we go any further, I want you to I want to give you a kind of view from the 4D side. But this is just 5D, and it looks like it's just playing tricks with 5D, just choosing precisely boundary conditions. But let's see what it means from the 4D point of view. What is the 4D interpretation of this? Well, okay, so let's start with the usual z equals 0. We move it a little bit to z equals epsilon, for example. Order 1 over n Planck, or order 1 over k. So we move the ultraviolet cutoff to be infinity, to be some very high scale. That's the first step that we needed to do. And then what we did yesterday is to add an infrared regulator. You can call it an infrared brain, or a black hole, or whatever you want. But you add something that is setting a particular, setting something special about a particular position in the extra dimensions. Okay, so the interpretation we did of this infrared brain is, at least when we did the scalar case, we saw that the infrared brain was introducing in this correlator some kind of Kaluza-Klein spectrum, right? And we interpreted these terms over here as a breaking of the conformal invariance. So conformal invariance is broken because there is some infrared brain or something stuck at a particular position. And then we went and said, okay, that means that when I'm entering into the extra dimension, the way I view that from the 4D point of view is that I'm describing some CFT at high energies with coupled to gravity, weakly coupled to gravity, and it stays, as I move, it stays being a conformal invariant, but at some point, abruptly, there is a breaking of conformal invariance. And I see this breaking clearly as the appearance of massive bound states. So in the 4D picture, the Kaluza-Kleins in the 4D picture, Kaluza-Klein modes are actually bound states of a conformal field theory that has been spontaneously broken. So this is our interpretation. Just because when we look at the two-point function with the Maldacena recipe, it really looks like this kind of behavior. Pound states have been formed because there is some conformal invariance breaking. Okay. Yes.
Oh, so you said if bound states form and it's spontaneously broken, or is it dynamically broken? Like, is it? It's like QCD kind of basically, like.
No, you're right. It doesn't have to be spontaneously broken. I just need some conformal invariant that becomes strongly coupled. But to generate bound states of a particular size, I need to break the conformal invariants.
Okay.
So yeah, the presence of the infinite brain is setting a particular mass scale. This. And you interpret these particle-like states as being bound states of your conformal field theory, strongly coupled theory. Okay. So that's one piece of the interpretation. Kaluza-Klein states are actually bound states of my 4D. And they are created because conformal invariance is broken, which is seen from the 5D point of view as the presence of some regulator. Okay. So now let's start talking about fields in the ball. What is the interpretation of ball fields? Let's say I do the following. Now I have my UV, IR regulators, and then I add a field, and the profile is UV localized. What do you think this field is going how do you think this field is going to fill the conformal field theory? Like this is a conformal field theory that is conformal all the way until it hits this infrared regulator. So the only way is from the 5D point of view, this is a field that is very UV localized, so it has mostly contact and support on the UV, and it has very little support on the IR. And because it's just because this brain is here, we are breaking conformal invariants, and there are these Kaluza-Klein showing up, then this guy is really going to feel very little the breaking of conformal invariants. Does it make sense? So the overlap or the wave function of a field being localized in one brain or the other or in the center is also telling you in the 4D side how this field couples to the breaking of conformal symmetry. So one way you can describe that is to say, okay, so I start with a field phi that is elementary. Sometimes you call that a source. And then this guy is coupled to some CFT. And these operators that appear because CFT has been broken are going to affect this field as a linear coupling. So we imagine that now we have a theory in 4D where we have the kinetic term for the field. And this field is also filling some of the conformal breaking. So the statement that this guy feels very little of the conformal breaking is the statement that this lambda is very small. So now you see we have a field, a kinetic term, and then we have a linear term on the field itself. What would you do in this case? Like, this is not the physical state. When you write down this kinetic term, now it has a linear term. You need to do something, right? To understand the physics of this field, I have to diagonalize this mixing. There is a mixing. And you know how it works now? So when you diagonalize the mixing, you are going to obtain a physical field. And because the mixing is so small, it's going to be your elementary field plus some order lambda, the CFT operator. So that's really, don't get confused because we are moving a lot from 4D to 5D. What I'm saying is that forget about the 4D interpretation. I have a 5D theory in ADS, And when I try to look at the what's going on with a field localizing the UV, I realize that it fills very little of the conformal breaking invariants. Conformal invariants breaking.
Why is
You could also imagine that it's a kinetic mixing. Well, we are just saying that there must be a mixing between the field and the CFT sector, and we represent it as this. So you need to induce a mixing from your elementary field to the CFT. You could do that, or you could do a kinetic mixing, for example. Why do you need to do that? Because you know that at the end of the day, your physical state must be what you started with, the elementary source, plus some older lambda. So, the overlap of this guy in 5D, forget about 44 moments, the overlap of this guy on the IR brain is very small, means it couples very little to conformal breaking. And from the 4D side, you want to interpret that as having an elementary field that happens to couple to the CFT, but this coupling is very small. So at the end of the day, your physical field is going to be mostly your elementary field. This guy doesn't feel the conformal breaking very much. So let's do the other limit. A guy that is really bounded to be near the IR. This is the IR, and this is the first conformal invariance breaking. Okay. So it's exactly the same picture. Now you say that this guy is going to be coupled to the conformal sector a lot, and we know that because the conformal invariance is broken, we have bound states. So I want to view this wave function, the physics of this wave function, as the following. I want to say that I have a Lagrangian, now in 4D, of an elementary field, plus another one coupling, now, and that time, of my field to the CFT. But now lambda prime is order one. What it means is that I have my elementary field and a bunch of bound states. That's what this represents. This is bound states. And at the end of the day, my physical field in this case is going to be the elementary plus some bound state of CFT with order one coefficients. So this field, the way this wave function, this field localized near the IR is interpreted, is as a mixture of a big mixture of an elementary field with CFT bound states. Okay? And of course, then we have the situation of delocalization. What does it mean to have a delocalized field in the bulk? Is to have a guy that is completely flat, so it doesn't care where it is in the bulk. So how do you compare these two guys? So you compare the mixing that happens here between the elementary and CFT, and the mixing that happens here, so the physical state is going to be an equal distribution of the elementary plus of CFT. But this is really another one in both sides. Whereas in this case, this was a big number, so you will have more weight on the CFT boundaries. This seems like a convoluted way of saying something simple. That the interpretation in ABS of UV, IR, or delocalized is very simple. UV localized fields are mostly elementary. IR localized fields are mostly bound states. And this guy is a little bit in between. It is both elementary and bound to the CFD. So let's apply these ideas to the breaking of a gauge symmetry. So I know when I have a plus plus boundary condition, I'm going to have a zero mode of the gauge field. It means we have a zero mode. Now, what is the interpretation of changing the plus plus boundary condition to minus in the UV? The interpretation is that changing from plus to minus is because the gauge symmetry has been broken by UV effects. And because the breaking happens in the UV, there is no remaining of this gauge symmetry. So imagine you have a gauge symmetry, just 4D gauge symmetry, and then you have a, you decide to break spontaneously this gauge symmetry at the Planck scale, or a very high scale. At low energies, what is the result of that? So you take a gauge symmetry, and then you break it spontaneously at a very high scale, let's say in Planck. What's going to happen? When the gauge symmetry is unbroken, you have massless modes, right? The photon is massless. When it's broken spontaneously, what happens? They become massive. And what is the, if the, the breaking happens at a particular scale, they become massive, and the mass of my gauge field is going to be order of the mass at which, the scale at which I'm breaking this, right? The same as the mass of the cell is of order electroweak scale. Okay? So, George, if I break spontaneously a symmetry at a very high scale, what do you think is the result at low energies?
It's more broken.
So all my gauge bosons become supermassive, hypermassive, to the Planck scale. I don't have gauge bosons in the low energy spectrum. But do I have anything remaining there?
I
do you think there is something remaining? Yes?
No, not much. If it's at the Planck scale, I would guess it's just suppressed by the interactions are suppressed by the Planck scale. But I don't know. I would guess there's not much. Yes.
There is something happening, actually. It's very important. And it's the gauge bosons decouple, but still the interactions are ruled by the gauge symmetry. So when you break a gauge symmetry spontaneously at a very high scale, actually you recover a global symmetry. Okay, the interactions, the kinetic tensors, everything is still ruled by this gauge symmetry, but there are no remaining. So it really looks like a global symmetry. So we are breaking a gauge symmetry at a very high scale. So at the end of the day, it's going to be look at a global symmetry. There will be no zero modes, but in the low energy, it will look as a global.
Is this like in a standard model?
Where, like, if we
have electroweak scale, but at low energies, energies much below that, you still find isospinners are useful for global symmetry.
That's a good example.
Yeah.
Yeah, so when you get symmetry broken at a higher scale than the physics you want to describe, we'll still have a remaining of that, is the global symmetry. And that's why you probably heard that in string theory you don't want global symmetries, right? So the way you can obtain global symmetries is by imagining that you are breaking gauge symmetries, which are fine in string theory, at very high scales. We know there are global symmetries in the standard model. So. One way of obtaining them is imagining that they are actually gauged but broken at very high scales. So the zero mode disappears, but the effects are still there as a global symmetry. Yes?
So if that happens, the gauge symmetry is spontaneously broken at a high scale. The global symmetry is always apparent at low energies. So even in the standard model, if you assume there's some big gut gauge groove, then that those remaining global symmetries should still structure the interact. Well, they should still be apparent at low energies. So we should look for new kind of like.
The problem is that gut is the way you test the gauge symmetries of the standard model is looking for the photon, looking for electromagnetic interactions and Z and W interactions, right? So, but if you really want to know what is the effect of exchanging one of these heavy guys, then you're going to see, in this case, M gut suppressed interactions.
As an isospin example, shouldn't we see some like SU5 isospin or something, the global symmetry?
If we had all the components, in gut theories you have leptons and quarks, they are all together, and there are other extra stuff. So if we have everything there, we could maybe, everything, all the matter was at low energies, then we could see that structure. But because we just have few components, the ones, the leptons and quarks, we don't see that. Okay, so way of obtaining global symmetries is gauge it at a very high scale. So one of the entries of the ADS-CFT is actually, and that was due to Witten, is that a global symmetry in 4D, in the conformal phase theory 4D, corresponds to a gauge symmetry in 5D. So the way you interpret global symmetries in your strongly coupled sector is precisely promoting these global symmetries to gauge symmetries in the bulk, and then saying that this, so 5D gauge symmetries on the boundary should be a global for the symmetry. The boundary, remember, is at 1 over M Planck. So. Okay. So this is plus plus going to minus plus. We just keep the same Kaluza-Klein spectrum because we didn't change the IR boundary condition. So the KK spectrum is the same. But instead of having a real gauge theory with a much less boson, we have a global symmetry. So next case is, instead of breaking it in one brain, break it in the other. Let's see what is the result. The result is very different. Okay. So instead of minus plus, we keep the plus here, but we do minus. The interpretation of this boundary condition is that the gauge symmetry is broken by infrared effects. And now we want to understand what is the result of that. So we already know that when we change from plus to minus in the infrared, we change all the Kaluza-Klein spectrum, we lift it, but also we know that we get a zero mode, an ultralight mode. The idea is that we have this zero mode at the beginning with plus plus, and breaking on the infrared with a minus is actually forcing this zero mode to modify its boundary condition slightly. So it goes from plus to minus boundary conditions, to vanish near the infrared. So the interpretation of the ultralight mode is the zero mode that has been changed from having a platform minus boundary conditions. Okay. So now we want to understand this ultralight mode versus the Kaluza-Klein modes. And what we see is that whereas the Kaluza-Klein are all bounded near the infrared, so those are the KKs, the ultralight is mostly flat. It really behaves like the zero mode. So the strength at which the Kaluza-Klein couples to the breaking of conformal invariance divided by the strength that the ultralight mode couples to the conformal invariance is different. And the difference is the fact that when this guy talks to this breaking, he has to do it suppressed by this volume factor. So the difference is a volume factor. And what I mean by all this strength versus strength, I'm just saying that when you look at the kinetic terms of these guys, or the wave function of this guy evaluated in the infrared or near the infrared versus the ultralight, there is a difference. The difference is that the ultralight has to share its support everywhere in the back, whereas the KK is really on top of the infrared band. And that's why the mass of the ultralight is the mass of the Kaluza-Klein divided by some factor that depends on the volume of the extra dimension. So the suppression in the mass of the ultralight is precisely because the ultralight gets its mass by talking to the infrared breaking, but the way it couples to the infrared breaking is suppressed respect to the Kaluza-Klein. All right. Okay. So now we understand why there is an ultralight, at least I hope you understand a little bit better why there is an ultralight mode. The fact that it's ultralight is because it has to, the way it talks to the conformal invariance is suppressed. So let's go back to five dimensions. Now the idea is, okay, so now we at least created a gap. And this gap is good to avoid direct detection. So I haven't seen these Kaluza-Klein resonances? Because they are too heavy. That's a person direct detection. But we have more data, right? From electrobeak, where is it? Because we looked at LEP with very high precision, percent precision, there is even better data in LEP, so we had to avoid precision electrobeak test. And this is test. And if you remember, what we were saying is a precision electrobeak test is a bunch of observables very well measured at LEP, of the first few percent. And but when you're a model builder, you don't want to look at all of them. You want to look at a reduced set. And this is the STU famous parameters. So the way the electrobeak corrections in S or T appear is something like M is actually V squared over the mass of new physics squared. So when you look at the polarizations that represent this S and T, and you look what is the effect on new physics, loops of new physics, it goes like this. So a simple way of getting rid of the ST parameter is to simply send this to 10 TeV, then you don't have any problem. But if we want TeV scale particles, This is, and this has been measured so well, this is not enough. So a TEV is not good enough. Or for the one. Oh, because there are some numerical parameters. Whereas a TEV is good enough for direct detection, because that's all we have been able to see. I think I have 5 minutes or less. Okay. So, let me see. So let's recap a little bit. We have said that in ADS, we can at least get a step number one of avoiding direct detection and build a realistic model of electroweak symmetry breaking. And the electroweak symmetry breaking happens because of boundary conditions, right? So there is no Higgs. To these theories that produce electroweak symmetry breaking without boundary conditions, they are called Higgsless models. That's models in 5 dimensions in ADS. But there was another proposal in the 80s that did exactly the same. It was claiming that you can break electroweak symmetry without a Higgs. That was called Technicolor. And if you remember, Technicolor is this proposal of electroweak symmetry breaking that died very soon. And the reason is that the S was order, and T actually, was order one. And since then, very, very few people are working on Technicolor, right? Because you know that electroweak precision tests are very hard to pass in Technicolor, so step number two is not right. But with the new E1 technology coming from extra dimensions, we are going to see how we can avoid these problems. So you will say, okay, so I'm claiming that I'm doing 5-dimensional models that are dual to some 4-dimensional strongly coupled theory. I already know that the simplest proposals of Technicolor, the ones I could say something about, I could estimate these parameters, are ruled out. So what is my hope of finding a viable Higgsless model? Well, the hope is that in extra dimensions, everything is calculable, and the view is very simple. Once you develop the intuition of what 5D versus 4D means, once you have your dictionary correct in your mind, you find mechanisms. So we are going to find mechanisms to protect the S and the T. Tomorrow, I guess. Yes? The S and T are... No, I don't think Michael did that. When I say LEP is great because it looked at percent level, it also means that when it looked at the on top of the Z pole, for example, if I measure E plus E minus on the Z pole, going, let's say, to E plus E minus. Right? And because you measure this coupling very well and this coupling very well and the energy distribution of this so, so well, then he was able to put any bounce on any bubble that could appear here. So the S and T are some linear combinations of the derivative of the over Q of the polarizations of these guys. For these particular combinations of these derivatives. So you see, because those measurements are so good, we are really in trouble, even at the loop level. You could look at the Peskiner's radar. Yes?
So if you have like fourth generation quarks or something that couple to SU2, then that would rule it out basically, because you get some loop contribution.
Yes. That's why fourth generation is in so much trouble.
Okay.
Yes. Remember that S, I told you the meaning on S of S is counting. These guys are counting how big is the sector is breaking electroweak symmetry. So we are going to see that tomorrow. What is the 4D interpretation or in Technicolor of S and T is counting how big is my sector. So if I have a SU technicolor, each theory that becomes tonic coupled and forms mesons and baryons and they break electrical symmetry, these S and T are actually ordered the number of technicolors. So if I have a huge sector breaking electrical symmetry, I'm in very bad shape. Why? Because S experimental and T experimental are more or less zero, order zero. At 0.1, minus 0.1, minus 0.0 something. Very, very small. Whereas the prediction, the in estimate from my strongly coupled theory is that it will go as the number of elements in my new set. So the situation, even just estimating, looks very, very bad on Technicolor, but we can interpret that in ABS and then start playing around. And we are going to find mechanisms to suppress both the S and the T. Yes.
So you said that the graviton's always localized at the plant frame.
Yes.
What consequences does that have for the fields that you're trying to localize the CAT frame? Sorry, the electric frame or the plant frame?
So the graviton still couples to anything as 1 over M Planck, right? Because the cutoff is this M Planck, everything is fine. The graviton is a fundamental field because it's localized near the UV. But the fundamental scale associated with the graviton is M Planck. And M Planck is a very high scale. No. No. But then you have the KK gravitons, the Kaluza-Klein resonances. They are localized near the infrared. You have a bunch of them. And that's why you are stuck in the infrared. You will see that the scale of quantum gravity is very low. So it does have a consequence. So things that are localized near the infrared have a local cutoff, the M Planck is TeV. It means that if we will be able to produce black holes at the LHC, even in Randall-Sundum. Not because the graviton couples as M Planck, but because the KK gravitons couple very strongly to you. To any source of electrical symmetry breaking. No question? Okay. See you tomorrow.